Welcome to Asimov's Spotlight. Here now, another story selected from the pages of Asimov's science fiction magazine.
When Joseph catches a glimpse of his new neighbor, Antonio, he can't help feel an immediate attraction. Antonio is tall, tanned, painfully handsome, and just happens to be a robot. But is romance a possibility in a world teetering on the brink of destruction? Find out in Sexy Apocalypse Robot, read and written by Sandra McDonald.
Joseph's new neighbor is handsome and lithe, with dark skin and darker hair, frequently half naked in the summer heat. During the day, his window shades are drawn, but at night he pulls them open and glides around his apartment with grace, pausing to bend over large tables illuminated by battery lamps. His bare chest is large and muscled and enticing, even with the distance between their apartments. Joseph is immediately in love with the man. "You're in lust, not love," says Diana from her floating box near his computer. "He's not a man, he's a robot," says Lola when she brings his grocery order. She taps her fluorescent orange biker's helmet. A nice one, not like those killer robots in the Bronx. She might be joking. Even before the apocalypse, Joseph had had trouble discerning jokes. In various classrooms, workplaces, and doctor's offices, people found it fun to pull his leg, to string along, to bamboozle. "Who let a robot move in?" Joseph asks. "The co-op board." "We don't have a board anymore." "We have me," Lola says, "plus Frank the plumber, and Joni, who keeps the plants alive in the lobby because no one else bothers to water them. Mr. Robot brought enough lithium batteries to light up the perimeter like it's Christmas, plus a dozen air-to-ground missile launchers and 100 pounds of freeze-dried Italian espresso. We would have given him this entire floor if he wanted it." "What does a robot need an apartment for?" Joseph asks. "Where else is he going to live? Just remember, he has rights too. He's not a sex bot here for your enjoyment." "I never said sex bot," Joseph says, but his defense is cut short by Lola kicking over his box with more force than necessary. She's short and old, but her legs are thick like tree trunks, and she could probably bench press any bare-chested robot who happened to come along. "You should go say hi," Lola says, skating away down the dim hallway past the ghost apartments filled with dust. "He paints, and he don't buzz." "Paints," Joseph mutters. He drags the box inside and kicks the door shut. What subjects would a robot paint? Other robots? Mechanical fruit? Landscapes of zeros and ones? Or maybe abstracts generated by the digital equivalent of electric dreams? Most of the robots he's met in his life have been physician assistants. Bland and impersonal, but perfectly capable of writing prescriptions. Now that civilization has mostly collapsed, he'd assumed all mechanicals had already been scavenged, torn apart for their power banks, or recruited into the very small and carefully distanced ragtag armies roaming the boroughs as soldiers or comfort workers or for target practice. Joseph opens the door again. "What's his name?" he calls. But Lola's already glided her way to the stairwell. Diana's box does a slow spin near the ceiling. "I can find out. Say the word." "You leave the building directory alone or the help desk will block you." "You are the help desk," Diana says blithely. Behind her, Mark pops into the frame with baby Nina in arms, waves, and ducks out again. It's nap time in London. Diana says, "I'm your trusted deputy, remember?" "Gotta go now," Joseph replies. Talk to you later, alligator. The chat box closes. Electra meows at the expensive box of groceries, which today includes oatmeal, canned sardines and lima beans, some apples past their prime, ever-present ramen noodles, bottled sparkling water, a freshly baked baguette, and a plastic dispenser full of expired birth control pills. Lola has brought him a book, too, though he never requests any. Today's offering is a hardcover by Truman Capote, who once lived in Brooklyn. Lola likes local connections. Electra meows again. "Yes, princess," he says. "I know you're hungry." Everything gets put away except for the baguette, which deserves to be cherished. Holding it close to his nose, Joseph inhales the beautiful scent for a long moment and tries not to think too much about bakeries and cafes, of French roast and fresh cream. Versions of these things might still exist in the city somewhere, but not for him. Lola has no such restrictions. Almost every morning she ventures outside, skating down the long driveway and past the wrought iron gates. The hired guards love her. Like Mr. Robot, she don't buzz. She's an elderly, well-armed senior citizen on her daily mission, risking the enhanced dangers of the city with a gimlet eye. For a dozen or so of the building's reclusive residents, and for not inconsiderable delivery fees, she will bring back groceries, medicine, pet supplies, ammunition, and Chinese food from the last takeout joint in New York City. Most of her customers live on the lower floors. In theory, the elevators might work on the infrequent days the city power comes on, but no reasonable person would risk being trapped when the chances of a fire department rescue are approximately zero. Joseph likes it here on the 15th floor, alone to do his work and talk to his cat. The walls and hardwood floors are thick. The realtor who sold him the apartment told him it was a pre-war classic six, whatever that means. He has three bedrooms, two of them shuttered and ignored. The main bathroom toilet doesn't work, but the one designated decades ago for a maid still flushes. The river view is why he moved in, because in pre-buzz days, that seemed important. Now the gates, the defensible driveway, and the clear lines of sight for his AK-15 are the reasons he stays. Well, most of the reasons. It's easy to stay when you have nowhere else to go, when all you've loved and valued has vanished, and floating chat boxes are the most important connections left in the world. The groceries safely put away, Joseph settles at his desk. Usually, he prefers to work at night. The apartment faces east to the rising sun and warms quickly, offset marginally by the solar-powered air conditioner that had cost him a month's salary, yet struggles to cool anything at all. But this morning, Diana sent him a rush job, and he can knock off the coating by noon if he's not distracted by shirtless Mr. Robot across the way, who has stepped out onto his balcony to toast the morning with a cup of coffee. "Surely that's absurd. Robots don't need coffee." Joseph pauses at his keyboard, considering. He opens the building chat net, which he usually regards as a cesspool of gossip and backstabbing, and finds the correct link for Mr. Robot's apartment. He sends a message. Dark roast or light? The robot must not be hooked in, or maybe he's not in the mood to answer. He stretches his arms, rippling the broad muscles of his naked chest, rolls his shoulders, limbering up for the day to come, for painting whatever robots might paint. A robot full of art, who drinks coffee and looks as flexible as a master yogi, who doesn't buzz. "Robot my ass," Joseph says, and turns back to his work. The neighbor answers, "Green tea." Joseph blinks at the words. Job finished, he slept the afternoon away and rose well after dark to fix himself some ramen and beans. Over in the robot's apartment, LED lanterns cast a glow on the shades. The evening breeze carries up sounds from the Black River to the open windows. The horn from a small ferry arriving on shore. A recorded warning from Roosevelt Island that unauthorized visitors will be shot on sight. Two glowing blue speedboats race each other sloppily past Brooklyn, the pilots probably drunk. No one will stop them, and no emergency responders will come if they crash or capsize. "Why green tea?" he types back. The answer comes a few minutes later. "It's soothing. What are you drinking?" He's drinking sugar floating in water that calls itself apple juice. It came in a cardboard box with an expiration date of 2 months ago. He has a bottle of limoncello gathering dust above the non-working refrigerator, but he's saving that for a special occasion that he sure will never come. "Pinot Noir," he types. It's second nature to lie. For instance, "How are you doing?" "Just fine." "Are those project requirements clear?" "Crystal." "Do you miss being able to hang out with real live people?" "Yes, of course." "I've got two glasses," Mr. Robot replies. Well now, that went faster than Joseph expected or desired. He wishes he could undo the message, rewind time, rethink the decision tree that brought him here. Perched on a windowsill, eyeing the night sky as if the universe is calling to her, Electra turns around and gives him a considering eye. A moment of silence ticks by on the chat. "Maybe tomorrow?" Mr. Robot writes. Joseph almost agrees, but he is self-aware enough to know that a delay would mean escalating anxiety, savage doubt, maybe even a migraine that would paralyze him in bed for 7 or 8 hours. He types that he will be right over and closes the conversation. "You should shower," Diana says from her box. "You're up early," Joseph says, "or very late. Nina needed a new diaper. Put on something nice, okay? Without wrinkles, that doesn't smell. Make a good impression." Joseph settles for a quick sponge bath with tepid water and fruity-smelling liquid soap. His binder is a tight fit after so many months sedentary and stress snacking, but he squeezes it on anyway. In the closet, he finds trousers that aren't too crumpled and a dark green shirt with buttons, but is distracted for several minutes by a search for deodorant and then a longer search for matching socks. Finally, he puts on his only pair of brown leather shoes, which feel almost unbearably hard after so long barefoot. Lantern in one hand, smooth, heavy bottle of limoncello in the other, he steps into the hallway and then goes back to brush his teeth. His hair looks long and greasy, so he pulls it into a man bun, takes it down again, puts it back. He wishes he could grow facial hair again. Diana's chat window appears in the doorway. "He's going to think you're not coming." "I'm coming," Joseph says. "Stop nagging." He sets off. He feels as apprehensive as his English ancestors must have when settling forth across the Atlantic. Their names are long forgotten, their stories lost in time, but he empathizes anyway. 63 steps along the dusty carpet and one small turn put him in sight of the two Otis elevators, their dull bronze doors sealed shut. Sometimes, late at night, he thinks he hears the ping of an arriving car. He imagines the door slamming open and billowing out clouds of gray dust instead of residents returning from dining or shopping or their well-paying jobs. He dreams of falling down the shaft, his bones splintering and flesh disintegrating when he hits bottom. Or maybe he survives the fall, but no rescuers come and he dies of thirst and starvation. It's irrational, these fears. He never had them before the collapse of civilization. Diana says it's stress and loneliness and anxiety, and what he really fears is being forgotten, left alone on the 15th floor, abandoned by the other residents. "Which is silly," he's replied. "He can always walk down the stairs if he has the insane desire to see anyone other than Lola. He just hasn't bothered to." The small black windows set in the elevator doors stare at him. "I'm not afraid of you," he whispers now, and sprints by them. Over in the next wing, a long hall of ghost apartments stretch toward Mr. Robot's doorway. A square of white light spills on the carpet down there, accompanied by the analog sound of classical music. Beethoven, maybe? Bach? He can never remember. He thinks of a dozen reasons to turn around and abandon this folly. The leather shoes really do hurt his feet. He should have looked for loafers, but his legs keep moving on their own. "Hello," Mr. Robot says, tall and sexy and casual. He's leaning against his doorframe, but very considerately has not crossed it. Joseph stops several feet away. After so long alone, it is surreal to be in the company of someone who's not short, sarcastic, and wearing roller skates. "Well, hi," he says, wincing at the crack in his voice. "I'm Joseph." "Antonio De Rosa," the robot says, a trace of Italian accent in his sonorous voice. "I've been looking forward to meeting you." Disappointingly, he has put on a shirt. It's a nice shirt, white linen with crisp cuffs and a small collar, but it covers too much skin, as do the soft gray trousers and the brown leather sandals, which offer glimpses of strong feet and neatly trimmed toes. Underneath the clothes, Antonio is long and lean, no doubt a skilled and attentive lover. "Lola speaks well of you," Antonio says. "She says you are a brilliant computer coder and you keep the entire building safe from cyber pirates." Whenever Lola says something nice, Joseph knows her motives are not to be trusted. If anything, she likes the money he sends her. She likes that he relies on her. Even back in the days when she was one of the rotating doormen downstairs, she was a shrewd assessor of human weaknesses and how she could exploit them. He was more or less appointed to keep the building network safe, but at least the actual hardware and chatnet are maintained by a nice lesbian librarian down in apartment 14. "I'm not brilliant," is all he says now. Antonio smiles. "Modesty is admirable." "I'm mechanical. I'm sure she told you that." "But you drink liquids." "Part of my programming." "And you paint." "Part of my job. Would you like to enter?" Yes, he would like to enter, very much indeed. But embarrassingly enough, his feet won't move. "Is something wrong?" Antonio's pleasant expression falters. "Am I not fit company after all?" "It's not... no. Eloquence fails, as it has so often in Joseph's life. His heartbeat begins a rapid increase in contemplation of all that could go wrong if he steps foot inside the apartment. The ceiling might fall in. The floor might give way. Antonio's programming might be deranged, and he'd kill anyone who steps into his lair. Joseph voices none of that. Instead, he says, "Germs. Sorry, all the germs." Antonio raises one eyebrow. Kudos to the programmer who built that nonverbal gesture into his software, because it looks utterly natural and not just a little adorable, even if the proximate cause is the idiot human in the hallway. "I don't carry any," Antonio says. "Obviously, I'm not susceptible to any you might have." "I know," Joseph says. "If it's the buzz you're worried about, I'm as harmless as a lamp." It's no use. All rationality is collapsing in Joseph's brain. If he doesn't retreat now, he'll really make a fool of himself. Here, have this, my welcome gift. It's better if you chill it. Goodbye. He stands the bottle on the floor, a lone soldier in the lost battle for companionship, and backtracks. Vaguely aware of Antonio calling his name, he walks faster past the doors where no one lives, where no one sleeps, where no one is cuddled with a loved one in front of screens of mass entertainment. He doesn't even notice the elevators. Back in his dark apartment, which he now realizes smells depressingly like mold, he strips off his shirt and binder, steps out of his trousers, kicks the awful shoes away, and throws himself on the sofa. How did it go? Diana's box hovers over his head. Does he have a fully functional penis? "Go to sleep, alligator," he says, not kindly. A pause. She considers. "See you in a while, crocodile," she says, and shuts down. Antonio's warm eyes. Antonio's lovely smile. He dreams of Antonio, and for a few hours at least, forgets everything else. This he knows. He will never have sex with another person again. He also knows he will never fly on a plane again, or dine in that Thai restaurant on Madison with all those handsome waiters, or see his niece Nina grow from sweet little baby in yellow pajamas to a confident woman ready to take on the world. But he doesn't know why there's a lovely bottle of amaretto sitting outside his front door when he next opens it for Lola. a lovely golden bottle, sealed. No note. Diana monitors the hall cameras. She should have notified him. Secret admirer, Lola asks, kicking today's groceries his way. Mr. Robot? I don't know, Joseph says. Lola tucks a strip of wayward tinfoil back up under her helmet and gives him an exaggerated wink. Don't break his dreamy heart. I might want it myself. Joseph closes his door. For finishing two more projects early, he's earned a bonus, which translates into indulgent groceries today. A quart of milk, four fresh eggs, a wedge of cheese, and a loaf of tomato and garlic focaccia bread. He wonders which bakery is open, which brave baker rises early every day to risk death by interacting with customers, suppliers, and delivery people. They must take special precautions like a drop box or lock safe, a place where money and bread can be exchanged at a safe distance. It's possible, he has read, for people who've never buzzed before to suddenly and fatally start. Lola believes tinfoil tucked under her helmet will protect her. In the online swamp of bad advice, scattered survivors also recommend prayers, religious amulets, charms made from the dust of loved ones, long-distance faith healers, and online cults that promise immunity, as well as guaranteed admission to the dazzling and magnificent afterlife, if you donate enough money in the here and now. Science says none of that will help, but neither can it explain why, on an innocent day in summer, during a regular sunrise without portents or prophecies, an infant newly born in Lakshmi Maternity Hospital in Tamil Nadu, India, began to emit a low-pitched noise that instantly turned the two nurses nearby into piles of brown dust. The infant's mother disintegrated on the table where she lay with her bloody legs splayed wide. A young doctor who had helped supervise the birth managed to get as far as the hallway before dissolving, but not before she had passed death to a custodian, a desk clerk, and three hospital visitors. Deep into a vexing project, Joseph hadn't noticed his news feeds filling with panic and mayhem until 12 hours into the apocalypse, when he stopped to stuff his face with pizza rolls and donuts. Over several cups of coffee, he watched the world collapse on live camera feeds. Buzz, whoosh, so went the world population, or at least those unlucky enough not to isolate in time. Quick dissolves into piles of dust, humanity undone in the rotation of a few days. It had taken weeks of heartbreaking and frantic coding to get Diana on a chat box. Mark thinks it's an alien invasion, she said, as flippant as ever. They saved the animals, didn't they? Destroyed mankind, but rescued the whales. It sounds like alien intelligence to me. All the animals in zoos vanished. All the pets in empty apartments and homes gone. Aquarium tanks left with nothing but water. Even the subway rats had disappeared, Lola said, and Joseph took her word for that. He'd read more than one variation of the alien invasion theory, but didn't believe it. If aliens wanted the world, it was theirs for the taking now. They could stroll in and help themselves to anything they wanted. But the skies stayed clear, and all the cities and towns and villages continued to die. Good morning, Diana says now as he logs in. The light behind her is muted. Rain in London. You look like you didn't sleep. You look like you tried to cut your bangs, Joseph said. She laughs and swipes at the jagged brown fringe on her forehead. I let Mark try. The good news is they'll grow back. He wishes he had gone to see her more often, that he had braved the humiliation of passing through borders and risking pat-downs and the frowns of immigration officials trying to match his passport gender to his appearance, all to visit the only person who loved him without equivocation. Of course, no borders are open now. Even if someone got the planes flying again or launched a boat across the Atlantic, trespassers would be shot on sight. You're staring, Diana says. I don't like them. They don't look like you. I'll fix them, she tilts her head. I did find out more information about your neighbor. I told you not to pry. "You didn't sound convincing," she says, and sends data cascading down his screen. Antonio DeRosa is the registered owner of a business called DeRosa Fine Art Restoration, with a pre-Buzz address on the Upper West Side. A well-designed website displays examples of his work and sample videos of the restoration process. His portrait on the site is indeed handsome. An observer who didn't know he was mechanical might take those little age lines around his eyes as genuine. "Who hires him these days?" Diana says. "Who cares about a Virgin Mary with a ripped canvas? Or blood splattered on a Van Gogh? I mean, everything here is still closed. Mark thinks we should sneak into the National Gallery and grab a Monet. I told him dots of paint are not worth getting buzzed." He smiles faintly because this is the Diana he remembers. The glint in her eye whenever she got a late-night harebrained scheme. The joy she took in testing outrageous suggestions. Electra rubs against his elbow, reminding him it's time for her snack. Diana says, "Send Mr. Sexy Robot a bottle of Amarula. It's South African. Or go loot a Monet at the Met as a housewarming gift." Lola tells him she's not going to go scour liquor stores for some obscure South African concoction, and then brings back two bottles of creamy brown liquid anyway. "One is for me," she says, but makes him pay for both. She has also brought him two more books he didn't ask for, H.P. Lovecraft and Walt Whitman. He can't imagine two more disparate authors. Lovecraft hated Brooklyn. Whitman adored it, even though it broke his heart. "Is the Met Museum open?" he asks before she leaves. "Oh, sure," Lola says. "In the gift shop, too. You can walk right in and help yourself. Get me a Picasso, will you? My apartment needs some decorating." She's probably joking, trying to flim-flam him, pull the wool over his eyes. Many people, pre-Buzz, seem to delight in confusing him with humor. Maybe his long history of inadvertently confusing other people is part of some odd, unfair, karmic seesaw. A similar seesaw balances him and Lola now. If she refused his money in shopping, he'd have to find someone else. If he fired her, she'd lose one of her most lucrative customers. They are checkmated or stalemated, one of those. Antonio sends a heart-shaped emoji after discovering the Amarula on his doorstep, and extends an invitation to come visit again. He promises social distancing if that will make Joseph feel safer about germs or the buzz or anything at all. Maybe Joseph could try. Maybe nothing catastrophic will happen. Electra nudges his leg. "Fine," he says. He washes up again, finds clothes that are decent, brushes his teeth and uses mouthwash too. Skirting by the elevators is no easier in daytime than nighttime. The ghost apartments are all quiet and contemplative. Behind them, the dusty and undisturbed. Mounds of people he recognized in passing in the lobby, but was otherwise happy to avoid getting to know. In the first few weeks of the buzz, Lola had tried to recruit Joseph into joining the volunteers, helping unplug appliances and turn off water valves throughout the building, but he'd refused to leave his own unit. Later, there'd been a resident vote about whether it would be respectful to sweep up the dead and put the dust in the garden, or just leave them where they were. Joseph didn't vote. "Hello," Antonio says, leaning against his doorway again. Joseph stops several feet away. "I'm not nervous today." "I'm very glad." Disappointingly, Antonio is wearing a shirt again, a nice blue jersey, slim fit with a deep V at the neck. His tan trousers are long and soft. "I much prefer people in person than in chat boxes." Joseph takes a step forward, two and three and four. "Welcome to the building." "So very pleased to be here," Antonio says, his mouth quirking. "Please, come in." The apartment is as spacious and high-ceilinged as Joseph's, but has the distinct advantage of being clean and orderly and filled with sunlight filtered through the pale window shades, no hint of the dying city outside. Beethoven or Bach or maybe Brahms drifts out of the invisible speakers, as gentle as rain. Along the walls are portable air conditioners and what might be dehumidifiers, all the better for precision climate control. If there was dining room furniture when he'd moved in, he's stored it elsewhere in favor of two easels, three work tables, and a large steel shelf unit stocked with brushes, solvents, paints, and other necessities of his trade. Hanging on the wall are antique wooden frames of gold or varnish, all of them empty. "You carried all of this up the stairs yourself?" Joseph asks. "It wasn't a bother. I don't get tired, and I'm very strong." Above their heads, the elaborate plaster ceiling is decorated with a forest of vines and leaves. Joseph remembers that he's been in this apartment once before, when the occupant was an elderly man named Blattner. He was a very short man who'd made a fortune in scrap metal and bought the luxury apartment for his wife, an even tinier woman from Boston. They'd needed help with their computer one day, and Lola, then one of the doormen, had recommended his assistance. "It'll be a mitzvah," she'd said, which he thought was some kind of birthday party. Antonio opens his bottle of Amarula, and they drink from delicate glasses that had belonged to Mr. and Mrs. Blattner. "Tastes like citrus," Antonio says. "And caramel." Joseph sips more. "Citrus and caramel together." Antonio is not careless. He's left no works in progress on any of the tables or easels, risking damage from a clumsy visitor. He escorts Joseph to the balcony, which offers a much more interesting view of the building's loggias and Art Deco embellishments than Joseph's own unit. Standing at the parapet with the sexiest robot in all of Manhattan, Joseph can see his own windows across the way and the shape of Electra watching them. "When I wasn't in use, I was stored in a closet at my owner's business," Antonio says evenly. "It was stupefyingly boring and stuffy, left alone with the abandoned projects, all of my training and skill, and all he'd trust me to do is sweep the floor, mop the toilet, and serve chilled water to the customers. But then he fell ill, and he knew his son didn't have the skill or will to carry on, so he freed me and gave me the business. I can't hate him too much." "Are you programmed to hate?" Joseph asks. Antonio sips more Amarula. "Not even a little." "People still pay you now to restore their paintings? People still pay you to protect their computer networks? Well, there's more need for that than for art." "Probably, but even without customers, I have years of projects left to work on. Do you like portraits? I have a dozen. Or landscapes? At least a dozen more. Torn canvases, water damage, broken stretchers, and split panels. How do you feel about French queens? I'm working on a lovely Blanche of Castile." Joseph looks into his glass. It's already empty. "I'm not really a fan." "Of queens? Of art." After a moment of silence, Antonio says, "That's a shame, but I am steadfastly dedicated to restoration. That's my baseline program. My entire purpose and passion in life. I don't even have genitalia." The Amarula might be just stronger than he'd imagine because Joseph feels knocked off balance. "You don't what? What? I thought you should know." Antonio's expression is apologetic. "Humans see my exterior and make assumptions about my sexual abilities, but then they're disappointed. I thought I should tell you up front. I know you'll understand because people presume..." "I forgot to finish something," Joseph says. He puts his glass on the limestone parapet so clumsily that it immediately tumbles over the side. "Oh, sorry, I'll replace that. But I really have to go. I didn't mean to upset you." "No, I'm not upset," Joseph insists. Down below, the glass smashes to the courtyard with a faint tinkle. He hopes no one was sitting down there enjoying the day. "I'll call you later." "What do you mean he's a robot with no genitalia?" Diana asks after he tells her. "If he drinks, he has to urinate, so he has to have a penis. It's required." He glares at her. "It's really not." "Well, don't get offended. I didn't mean you, of course." His surgeon is dead. The hospital where he was to have his procedures is shuttered and derelict. The Rainbow Clinic, full of nice, supportive staff, is now a giant urn. All of Joseph's years of planning, of spreadsheets and cost analyses and arguing with insurance companies, all of his anonymous posts to online forums seeking advice, all of it collapsed by one infant in India. He is stuck in a body that doesn't fit, and the expired birth control pills no longer save him from the cramps, bloating, and messiness of heavy periods. His breasts are growing bigger every month. He hates the sound of his girlish voice and has to work hard to force it downward. Lola has many resources at her disposal, but even she is no longer able to secure him testosterone. And the shipments Diana has arranged invariably end up stolen long before they reach the building. I mean, he has to have something, Diana amends, a port, a drain. But even without genitalia, he can do oral sex. Joseph puts both hands over his face. I hate you, he says. A bottle of Grand Marnier Cordon Juan shows up on his doorstep the next evening. A very pretty bottle, orange-red. Once again, Diana didn't mention anyone in the hallway. She is a traitor. Antonio says, I found the bottle in the pantry. I hope it's not spoiled. It is so much easier to talk over a box than in person. But it would be less distracting if Antonio was wearing more than just his trousers. He's stretched out on his white sofa, a sexy, shirtless robot, dark skin lovely against plump cushions. Electric candles flicker beside him, casting a romantic glow. Trying to keep focus, Joseph says, I asked Diana. She says it won't go bad. Diana is a liquor expert. The Cordon Juan tastes like extra strength orange juice. Joseph had drunk one small glass before calling Antonio, and now he drinks another. With the sun long gone, sporadic lights in Brooklyn look like fireflies in the dark. He imagines Walt Whitman's New York looked like that a long time ago. Whitman, who tried to change the world with words and who died broken, alone in New Jersey. On the windowsill, Electra watches something in the sky with a tilt of her feline head, her tail curling and uncurling. Diana is my twin, Joseph says. Antonio stretches one arm above his head, slow and almost teasing. I was part of a limited run. Only 50 in my series. All of us programmed in art conservation, destined for museums around the world that were updating their disaster preparedness programs. My museum got bombed before I was even packed up for transport. Nothing left to conserve there. One of the project consultants got me at a discount price and took me home to his studio. He's the one who kept me in the closet most of the time. I'm sorry, Joseph says. The road led me here. I have no subroutines for regret. Joseph says, my sister moved to London 5 years ago. We'd never been apart before then. He hesitates. We were born identical, he says. He waits, but Antonio says nothing, as if he hadn't heard or processed the revelation. Maybe mechanical robots don't understand twins or transgender, or perhaps they don't care. The liquor has made Joseph's belly warm and his inhibitions irrelevant. Are you sure you don't have genitalia? He asks. Amusement flickers on Antonio's face. Fairly sure. Although I might have some and simply be programmed not to notice. Would you like to inspect me? In her silenced box, Diana gives a huge thumbs up. She thinks Antonio is human. Being mechanical is a story he tells, a joke or a hoax or a con, which means confidence game. Such an odd phrase. If someone needs to deceive others to achieve a goal, they must lack the confidence they can achieve it on their own, Joseph thinks. Over at the window, Electra raises her hackles and hisses. Joseph registers a faint whirring noise and a tiny white light behind the glass. Security, he snaps, and the computer simultaneously plunges the apartment into darkness while activating the floodlights outside. A quadcopter no bigger than Electra herself is hovering 15 feet beyond the windows, piloted by someone who could be on the river or over in Brooklyn or on the other side of the world. A rival programmer, maybe. An agent of the ramshackle but dangerous government. Joseph has a moment in which he could disarm the system, but he doesn't. The apartment defense system locks on and fires. Bullets pierce two wings and rip into the housing, slamming the quadcopter sideways. It dips sharply, rises, then careens towards Antonio's apartment. "Watch out!" Joseph shouts to the chat box. In a shower of sparks and with a screech of metal, the drone cartwheels over Antonio's balcony wall and through his door. Antonio's chat goes dark. In her box, Diana is busy cataloging any more defense measures that might be necessary. "Shelter in the bathroom," she orders. Barefoot, dressed only in a t-shirt and boxer shorts, Joseph does not bother to argue. Instead, he runs, faster than he has in years, with more purpose than anything since the onset of the buzz. Down the hall, past the harmless elevators, to Antonio's closed door. He pounds on it. "Open up," he yells. No answer. The sprinklers in the ceiling haven't activated, nor have any of the fire alarms, but he doesn't even know if the systems are working. He bangs with a closed fist. If the lithium battery in the drone explodes, if the fire spreads, the door swings open. "I'm fine," Antonio says immediately. White fire retardant foam clings to his amazingly muscled forearms and dots his bare chest like bits of whipped cream. Just a small fire, easily extinguished. Joseph throws his arms around him into a ridiculously tight and relieved hug. Antonio doesn't return it, but he doesn't resist either. A win in Joseph's book. Just holding another body, just squeezing it and feeling weight, feeling warmth, feeling skin that is not real but feels real, is enough to make his eyes sting. Behind them, a lantern flickers off and on while bits of drone smolder on the floor. "Can I have this?" Joseph asks, muffled against Antonio's bare chest. The silence where a heartbeat should be does not deter him. "Even if you can't do anything else, can I have this once in a while?" Antonio's right hand slowly rises to the back of Joseph's head. "Is it enough?" Antonio asks, gestures of affection from a mechanical being. Joseph nods. Silence. No indication at all of what Antonio is thinking in his robot brain. Joseph realizes he is about to be rejected once again, another in a long line of crushing humiliations. Kids at school mocking him, teachers refusing to use his correct pronouns, college administrators refusing to honor dorm requests, doctors at the student clinic not giving him what he needs, employers asking him to fill the correct boxes on applications, the police officer snidely insisting on calling him Miss and Ma'am. "Yes," Antonio says softly. His left arm rises and comes around Joseph. "This I can do." Joseph decides he's never going to let go, that he's going to hold on for every spin of the world that his body can stand. But eventually his arms begin to ache, and Antonio says they should check on the drone. The pieces are scattered on the floor, charred and useless. On the nearest easel, undamaged, sits a painted canvas of a woman in a royal red gown. She looks at them with a dispassionate gaze. Antonio says, "You know, next time you want to come over, you don't have to arrange such a dramatic excuse." "That's a joke, right?" Joseph wipes his wet eyes and smiles. "Very funny." The rest of the night is not spent hugging on the sofa, no matter how tempting the possibility is. Instead, the scowling Russian who is in charge of the building's physical security comes to inspect the damage to Antonio's apartment and grunt his approval of Joseph's security measures. He is much shorter in person than Joseph thought he'd be. The Russian either doesn't know English or pretends not to, and his occupation pre-buzz is not something anyone will discuss, even in the most secretive threads of the resident chat net. Diana translates the man's assessment of the situation, which is that the drone was an amateur attempt to scout apartments for future robberies. Diana adds, "He also says you could move lower in the building, where there are more defenses." "I'm not moving anywhere," Joseph says. Electra deigns to let the Russian pet her sleek black fur. "Nice little robot," he says, accent thick before heading off with the remains of the drone in a cardboard box. After the visit, Joseph falls into restless sleep and does not wake until late afternoon when a Latina woman who is not Lola delivers his groceries. "I did my best," she says, wiping sweat from her forehead. "It's a lot of stairs. You're going to have to pay more next time." "Where's Lola?" Joseph asks. "You didn't get the email?" The memorial service is broadcast live from the lobby. Frank the plumber reads from a Bible, and Joni the plant lady speaks of Lola's unwavering commitment to the residents. Joseph watches numbly from his sofa. He didn't like her at all, but never wanted her to end up as a pile of dust while fulfilling customer orders. To his relief, Lola's demise had nothing to do with his groceries, but instead a personal trip to a floral shop on 2nd Avenue. The tin foil under her helmet had done nothing to protect her when she'd ventured too close to the florist, who had never buzzed before. "She wanted the flowers for her daughter's grave, I hear," Antonio says later, as they drink a toast on his balcony. "I didn't know she had any family," Joseph said. "The daughter died many years ago of cancer." Joseph looks down at the courtyard and the immense round water fountain that no longer works. FDR Drive, which once teemed with traffic day and night, is blocked off by concrete barriers and barbed wire. Grass has sprouted through cracks in the asphalt. Wildflowers creep along the median. "How did you find all that out?" Joseph asks. "The resident chat net. And your sister's avatar has been very helpful, too. She introduced herself last week. I like what you've done with her." "What he's done, apparently, has given Diana too much independence. Let her run amok when she should be safely confined. But Diana never did like rules or regulations." Out on the river, a woman in a bright yellow life vest is paddling a kayak toward Brooklyn. Above her, the skyline rises to a darkening sky that stretches east toward places Joseph will never see or visit, across an ocean deep and deadly, and onward to an island filled with more victims than survivors. On the island is a city, and in that city is a South Kensington flat, and inside that flat, undisturbed, is a morning cup of coffee long evaporated, a crib with pink sheets faded by sun through the windows, and three piles of dust on the family room carpet. "I tell myself a story that she's still here," Joseph finally says. "And then I make that story come alive, as best I can." Antonio lifts his champagne glass. "I tell myself a story that art still matters, even if 100 years from now, I'm the only one left on this entire island to appreciate it." They watch the kayaker make steady progress toward shore, which she reaches under a sky brightening with 1,000 bits of starlight. Joseph turns and touches Antonio's hand. "Will you show me more of the paintings you save? My sister loved art."
Thanks for listening to Asimov's Spotlight, a feature of Asimov's Science Fiction Magazine. If you liked what you've heard, consider subscribing to Asimov's. We're available in print and digital. And please stop by again next month to hear another exciting story chosen from our pages.